content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the January 26, 2024 issue of the Week. This week's cover drawing is a snowy scene. Looks like it's in farm country. I'm guessing it may be Iowa. An abominable snowman is standing on top of a small hill. He's in a power pose, only he's got the head of Donald Trump, making a screaming look. Off to the side, a smaller Nikki Haley has just hurled a snowball at him, and a little further back, Ron DeSantis is up to his waist in snow, and he's also making a snowball. The headline is Storming Ahead. After Trump's Iowa win, can anyone stop his march to the GOP nomination? That is our first main story. We'll start with that. Trump gains momentum with Iowa victory. Donald Trump commandingly won the Iowa caucuses this week in a show of force that affirmed his dominance within the GOP and made his path toward the party's presidential nomination seem all but inevitable. In a race called by the Associated Press a mere 31 minutes after caucusing began, Trump took 51% of the vote, and Florida Governor Ron DeSantis finished a distant second with 21%, followed by Nikki Haley with 19%. The former president's 30-point victory margin shattered the previous record in a contested Iowa Republican caucus, set when Bob Dole won by 12.8 points in 1988. Trump, who faces 91 felony counts and four criminal cases, won in 98 of Iowa's 99 counties. He lost the remaining one to Haley by a single vote. On a night when sub-zero temperatures cut turnout to its lowest level since 2000, Trump swept virtually every demographic, winning rural and city voters, young and old voters, men and women. In a victory speech, he made an uncharacteristic call for everybody, our country, to come together, before pivoting to calling the 2020 election stolen and saying Joe Biden is destroying our country. Biotech entrepreneur Vivek Ramaswamy exited the GOP race after coming in fourth with 8% of the vote. The first-time candidate who staked out Trump-aligned positions such as sending troops to Mexico to fight the cartels endorsed Trump. Former Arkansas Governor Asa Hutchinson likewise departed, after drawing less than 1%. My message of being a principled Republican with experience and telling the truth about the current front runner did not sell in Iowa, he said. That left only Haley and DeSantis as challengers. Calling the GOP contest a two-person race between her and Trump, Haley headed to New Hampshire, which holds its primary on January 23rd, and where polls show her tied with or in second place to Trump. DeSantis bypassed New Hampshire, where he's polling in single digits, and flew to South Carolina amid reports that the super PAC supporting him was laying off staff. Going to be tough sledding, said a campaign insider. What the editorial said. It was a great night for Trump, said National Review, but not so much for the Republican Party. The GOP's rush to throw itself into the arms of Donald Trump again seems ill-advised. He leads Biden in the Real Clear Politics polling average by only 1.1 points, a notably weak showing given Biden's feeble condition, and that's before Democrats have fully, truly turned their fire on Trump, and before a possible felony conviction. The party has better alternatives, but if the Iowa results are any indication, perhaps not for very long. The MAGA movement is now the Republican establishment, said the Minneapolis Star Tribune, and victory for Trump is near. He could still be derailed by a court case, but even that might not do it for Republicans, since 63% of caucus goers told Iowa pollsters he'd be fit for office even if convicted. Meanwhile, 66% believe the 2020 election was stolen. Millions of voters in 49 states haven't yet spoken, and we urge those who value truth to stay engaged. What the columnist said: Trump couldn't have scripted it any better, said Zachary Basu in Axios. He won overwhelmingly while spending far less time campaigning in Iowa than any of his rivals. Neither DeSantis nor Haley knocked the other out of the race, meaning voters seeking a Trump alternative will remain divided. And he got Ramaswamy's departure and endorsement. The astonishing speed and sweep of his victory should be a massive wake-up call to Republican skeptics still dreaming of a post-MAGA world. DeSantis is a dead man walking, said Scott Lehigh in the Boston Globe. He put all his eggs in Iowa's basket, barnstorming every one of the state's 99 counties in more than 150 campaign stops. But his effort to pitch himself as a less divisive Trump light failed because Republicans want the full strength stuff. Haley fared slightly better, doing well among moderate and highly educated voters, said Nate Kahn in the New York Times. But the results confirmed her appeal is extraordinarily narrow, and without making inroads into the GOP's working class base, she has no path forward. Yet Trump's deceptive Iowa results aren't the show of strength they appear to be, said David Von Drehl in the Washington Post. Amid measly turnout, fewer than 60,000 people were motivated to caucus for him. Many were rural voters whose allegiance to Trump is a given. In towns and cities, his showing was far weaker, and it's in such places and not farm country that the election will be won or lost. For the primary, the writing is on the wall, said Michelle Goldberg in the New York Times. A year ago, when most Republicans told pollsters they wanted to move on from Trump, a different outcome was imaginable. But instead of uniting against Trump and his multiple indictments, DeSantis, Haley, and other Republicans indulged the MAGA movement while hoping some outside force would make Trump go away. Resistance may have been futile in any case, given a GOP base that loves drama and yearns for a strong man. Convinced that our country is going to hell, Iowa Republicans have sent it a little further on its way. Controversy of the week. Gaza. Has Israel's war on Hamas become genocide? Israel was created as a refuge from genocide, said Kenneth Roth in The Guardian, and now it stands accused of that very crime. At the International Court of Justice in The Hague last week, South Africa alleged that Israel is violating international law by committing genocidal acts to destroy Palestinians in Gaza. South Africa's case is persuasive. It argues that Israel has shown an indifference to Palestinian civilian life, dropping bunker buster bombs and dumb munitions in heavily populated areas. At least 23,000 Palestinians have been killed in the three-month war, including 10,000 children. In nearly all of the territory's 2 million residents have been displaced from their homes, 70% of which have been damaged or destroyed. Israel insists it is simply acting in self-defense following Hamas' October 7th slaughter of 1,200 Israelis, and it calls South Africa's case an absurd blood libel. But South Africa presents strong evidence that Israel has genocidal intent, said Mark Leon Goldberg in the New Republic, quoting numerous officials who have called for the destruction or removal of Palestinians in Gaza. They include Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who has twice referred to the biblical nation of Amalek, which God ordered the ancient Israelites to wipe out, men and women, infants and sucklings. Accusing Israel of genocide is a moral obscenity, said Brett Stevens in the New York Times. In recent decades, up to 3 million North Koreans have perished in a regime-induced famine. Hundreds of thousands of Syrians have been gassed, bombed, and tortured to death by dictator Bashar al-Assad, and more than 1 million Uyghurs have been thrown into re-education camps by China. Yet only Israel, the world's sole Jewish state, has been charged with genocide at the ICJ. How curious. The civilian casualty figures in Gaza are heartbreaking, but the blame belongs to Hamas, which knowingly hides fighters and weapons between, behind, and beneath Palestinian civilians to gain international sympathy. If any party to the conflict is guilty of attempted genocide, it is Hamas, said Max Boot in the Washington Post. The group's charter explicitly calls for the destruction of Israel and the slaughter of Jews, and they proved their sincerity on October 7. Self-defense cannot excuse or justify acts of genocide, said Megan K. Stack in the New York Times. It's for the ICJ to determine whether Israel has cleared that high legal bar. But the war has clearly ceased to be, if it ever was, a targeted retaliation against Hamas, whose leaders live in Qatar, or a mission to free Israeli hostages, only one of whom has been rescued. A verdict in the case is years away, but if the ICJ orders an emergency ceasefire, it could galvanize international opinion against Israel, making it harder for the U.S. to continue funding and defending Israel's extraordinary spasm of violence in Gaza. That's already happening, said Barak Ravid in Axios. In public, President Biden still gives Israel his full support, but behind the scenes, he's increasingly frustrated by Netanyahu's refusal to scale down the carnage in Gaza. Words matter, said Andrew Sullivan in his Substack newsletter, and what we're seeing in Gaza isn't genocide, but it is infanticide. It's hard to confront the horror of thousands of dead children and not conclude that we are witnessing a war crime that will stain Israel's reputation for generations, no matter what the war crime is called. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It was a good week for porch pirates after Quebec police warned the public against posting security camera images of thieves stealing packages from their doorsteps. In Canada, we have a presumption of innocence, said an officer. Posting that picture could be a violation of private life. It was a good week for closing arguments. After Donald Trump urged supporters to go vote for him in this week's Iowa caucuses, despite a life-threatening cold snap. You can't sit home, Trump said before his record 30-point win. Even if you vote and then pass away, it's worth it. It was a good week for the melting pot. After an analysis by the Pew Research Center found that 1 in 10 restaurants in the U.S. now serve Mexican cuisine. Mexican food is American food at this point, said Pew's Aaron Smith, and vice versa. But it was a bad week for longevity after Guinness World Records suspended the title of oldest dog ever, held by Bobby the Portuguese Mastiff. Over suspicions, the pooch was not 31 when he died last year. Skeptics note Bobby's paws are different colors in photos of him as a puppy and in old age. It was a bad week for superlatives after the city of Davenport, Iowa, canceled its annual Ice Extravaganza ice carving contest due to the dangerously low temperatures gripping the Midwest. Expected conditions are simply unsafe, said organizer Kyle Carter. Finally, it was a bad week for vocations. After police in India said hundreds of men had been tricked into paying fees to apply for fake jobs that involved impregnating childless wives. No victim of the con so far has come forward to complain, said an official, possibly because of shame. This week's briefing, titled The Endangered Amazon, scientists fear the world's largest rainforest is approaching an environmentally catastrophic tipping point. Why is the Amazon in trouble? Since the 1970s, about 17% of the rainforest, an area larger than Texas, has been deforested by loggers or cleared to make space for cattle, crops, and mining. That destruction accelerated under Brazil's last president, right-wing nationalist Jair Bolsonaro, with deforestation surging 60% during his four-year term. Some scientists now believe that the mounting stresses on this critical ecosystem, deforestation, rising heat, and worsening wildfires, mean the South American rainforest could soon suffer a sudden and irreversible dieback. Satellite images currently indicate that 75% of the rainforest has lost resilience, meaning it can't recover quickly from a drought or wildfire. Should the Amazon pass the tipping point, one recent study suggests, more than half the rainforest could turn into savanna in a few decades. Billions of trees and animals would die, global weather patterns would be upended, and climate change would intensify. The Amazon, explains climate scientist Tim Linton, feeds back to everything. What could cause a collapse? The Amazon is so vast, it spans 8 South American countries, over 2.5 million square miles, about 90% the size of the contiguous U.S., that it generates its own climate. Some 20 billion tons of moisture evaporates from the leaves of its 390 billion trees every day. That water condenses into clouds, then falls back to the earth as rain. The Amazon's dense canopy stops the sun from drying out the soil, preserving this loop. But research by Brazilian climate scientist Carlos Nobre suggests that if 25% of the original Amazon is deforested, the region's flying rivers of vapor will deteriorate to such an extent that most of the Amazon will not be able to survive. Nobre warns that even if deforestation is reversed, the savannization of the Amazon could still occur if global temperatures climb 2.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. About 1.2 degrees Celsius of warming has already occurred. Hitting those markers means the Amazon as we know it today would disappear, said Nobre. The forest would only remain in the west because the Andes drive a lot of rainfall in the region. Is rainfall decreasing? The Amazon receives about 6 to 10 feet of rain a year, but a recent study published in the journal Science Advances indicates that the region is getting drier. Soil moisture has decreased over the past four decades. The dry season has expanded by up to 15 days. And there have been three once-in-a-century droughts in the past 14 years alone. During last year's drought, made more intense by the El Niño climate pattern, a major Amazon River tributary fell to its lowest level in more than a century. Other tributaries drained until there was nothing but mud, cutting off communities that rely on river transportation. Brazil's fourth largest hydroelectric dam had to stop generating power because of the lack of water. Such droughts also stress trees, causing them to shed leaves, resulting in more ground debris that could fuel forest fires. It's the perfect combination for a big barbecue of the Amazon, said Yale ecologist Paulo Brando. How will this affect climate change? The Amazon has been called the lungs of the world because of the colossal amount of carbon dioxide it absorbs from the atmosphere. The region is thought to store about 123 billion tons of carbon in its trees and soil, more than three times as much as humans emitted in 2022. There's this huge climate mitigation service that we are getting for free, said John Miller of the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration. Global warming would be much worse if trees were not taking this up. But deforestation means that the Brazilian Amazon's carbon absorption rate has fallen by about 1% a year since 2001. And partly because of rotting plant matter, the southeastern Amazon may now be releasing more carbon than it soaks up. As well as speeding up climate change, this degradation could drastically affect weather systems around the world, including in the U.S. What could happen? A computer model developed by Princeton researchers suggests that the total deforestation of the Amazon would set off a ripple effect, pushing dry air over the western U.S. from December to February. The coastal northwest could receive 20% less rain, while the Sierra Nevada snowpack, a crucial source of water for farms in California's Central Valley, could shrink by 50%. Amazon deforestation will not only affect the Amazon, said study co-author David Medvigi, it will not be contained. Our government's trying to stop this destruction. Brazil's leftist president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva, who returned to office last year, made Amazon restoration central to his election campaign. And deforestation in the Brazilian Amazon has reduced on his watch, dropping by half in 2023 to its lowest level since 2018. Still, an area six times the size of New York City was cleared last year. Last summer, Amazon countries held their first summit in 14 years, with leaders agreeing to step up law enforcement cooperation in combating wildcat logging, mining, and burning. But the attendees did not back Lula's pledge to end illegal deforestation by 2030. For the indigenous peoples of the Amazon, none of this is sufficient. Our Mother Earth is screaming for help, said Oliveira Ticuna, who saw the rivers near his village shrink to a trickle in last year's drought. It's time to defend her. Moving into the best columns of the week. First two come from the U.S. David French from the New York Times says, How Trump Transformed Red America. The prospect of a second Trump term is terrifying for many reasons, said David French. But what I dread most is how his reelection would accelerate the ongoing cultural transformation of red America. In towns like mine in Tennessee, Trump is without question the single most culturally influential person, revered far more than any pastor, politician, coach, or celebrity. My fellow Christian evangelicals treat Trump as a prophet, with his followers dutifully emulating their cult leader's grievance-filled extremism and boorish behavior. The result is a religious movement steeped in fanaticism but stripped of virtue. American evangelicals no longer think of politicians' personal and public morality matter. In fact, Trumpism has led to a wave of what has been dubbed vice signaling, in which Trump's core supporters convey their tribal allegiance by being deliberately rude, transgressive, or otherwise unpleasant, just to demonstrate how little they care about conventional moral norms. Many now justify threats of violence and actual violence against Trump's opponents and are described by friends and family as lost. A Trump win in 2024 would absolutely convince countless Americans that virtue is for suckers and vice is the key to victory. Troubling evidence on trans care. New studies are raising more red flags about gender-affirming care for minors, said Ian Kingsbury. A study in Finland headed by adolescent psychiatrist Ritakirtu Kaltiala, who has worked with more than 500 transitioning teens, found that the standard protocol of puberty blockers and cross-gender hormones did not resolve the emotional problems of most transitioning teens, with 53% receiving psychiatric help after gender reassignment, compared with 15% before the interventions. Kaltiala has found that the majority of teens who have gender dysphoria today were born female and have suffered serious developmental and mental health problems for years. More than 25% are on the autism spectrum. Many transitioners come to regret hormonal interventions and their serious side effects, Kaltiala said. They were not thriving, she said. Instead, their lives were deteriorating. A Canadian study of 28 detransitioners revealed that they were not properly informed of the risks, complications, and limitations of the treatments, with great regret arising years later. The reality is that many trans-identified children are vulnerable and confused, and that treating all gender dysphoria with irreversible medical interventions is irrational and cruel. This column comes from Australia. Why are we still celebrating Australia Day? Asked Eleanor Catalaris. Each summer on January 26, we mark the 1788 arrival of the first 11 British ships to the Australian continent with parades, fireworks, citizenship ceremonies, and lots of lounging on the beach. It's a callous way to commemorate what we now recognize was the beginning of colonization and the subsequent trauma, injustice, and dispossession faced by Indigenous Australians. Many Indigenous, in fact, refer to the arrival of the First Fleet as Invasion Day. That's why I applaud the announcement last week by supermarket chain Woolworths that it would stop carrying Australia Day merch such as bucket hats and beer koozies following Kmart's similar decision last year. The companies say that demand for patriotic tchotchkes has fallen, but in truth, it's icky that big business ever wanted to commercialize and capitalize on such a dark chapter of our history. Sure, some Aussies are griping that woke corporations are attacking our freedom, but more and more of us are calling to either change the date of our national holiday or downplay the First Fleet connection and make the day about unity or democracy. What we choose to celebrate and how we choose to celebrate matters. We're at the last word, our feature article, A Graveyard Mystery. The staff at Hartsdale Pet Cemetery were used to dealing with unusual requests, said Andrew Kay in the New York Times. Then came Patricia Short. Ed Martin III was 14 years old when he began working at his father's pet cemetery. And in the decades since, he has tended to the graves of innumerable dogs, many cats, flocks of birds, a few monkeys, a lion cub, a Bengal tiger, and countless other creatures from every corner of the animal kingdom. In all that time, after all those burials, there was only ever one request a few years ago that gave him pause. Calling that morning on January 29th, 2020, was Bruce Johnson, a lawyer from New York who had in his possessions the cremated remains of a woman named Patricia Chart. Chart had died at her home in Mexico at the age of 92. In her will, she had requested that her ashes be interred at the Hartsdale Pet Cemetery, just north of New York City. She had no next of kin. The executor of her estate was not a family member or friend, but merely another lawyer at the firm. There were no further instructions. The thought of burying a human as a pet at a pet cemetery for Martin was not itself particularly confounding. Alongside the 80,000 or so animals currently interred at his family's graveyard are approximately 900 people, including all four of his grandparents, who wish to rest eternally with their pets. But this case felt different. Chart, in death, seemed to be alone. Please let me know what is involved in purchasing a place of rest for the decedent, and then we will probably arrange to have the remains shipped directly to you, Johnson wrote, with lawyerly formality, in an email later that day. There will be no funeral or burial ceremony. Sitting at his desk, Martin felt both bewildered and sad. Who was this woman who had died more than 2,000 miles away? Why would she be laid to rest at a pet cemetery all alone? Hartsdale Pet Cemetery was founded almost by chance in 1896 when a prominent Manhattan veterinarian let a grieving client bury her dog at his Westchester apple orchard. It was not long before pet owners began asking to be buried there too, with records showing human burials in the cemetery as early as the 1920s. The cemetery was the first of its kind in the United States, and in some sense, it was ahead of its time. There are now hundreds of pet cemeteries nationwide. These days, Hartsdale buries about 300 animals and a half dozen humans per year. Martin, who began working at the cemetery in 1980, was slow to first to embrace the family business. His father, Ed Martin Jr., purchased the graveyard with a friend in 1974, and back then, Ed Martin III found it all a bit embarrassing. The arrival in 1983 of Stephen King's Pet Cemetery did not help. All my friends' parents were doctors and lawyers and Wall Street people, Martin said. He started working at the graveyard as a teenager, mowing the grass and digging graves. After college, he dabbled in accounting, with two separate stints at PricewaterhouseCoopers. He went to law school and graduated with honors, but the corporate environment, cold and competitive, did not suit him. He returned to the cemetery in 2003 and has worked there ever since. His job, Martin believes, contains elements of therapy. He has heard so many people over the years confess with some guilt that they struggled more with the deaths of their pets than with those of their parents. But there was no one around to grieve for Chart. So, on an unseasonably warm March day, Martin walked her ashes himself to a vacant plot in the cemetery. He watched as the foreman and supervisor plunged their shovels into the hard ground. In half an hour, they had a grave, no more than 3 feet deep. Martin had no idea who this woman was, but he grew emotional as her urn was lowered into the earth. The men stood in silence, and Martin, so accustomed to comforting others, whispered some words of comfort to himself. The soil was restored. A small gray headstone was installed. As a business matter, Chart's file was closed, and yet Martin's question about her, about who she was, what she was doing there, still hung in the air. Among the things Martin did not know was that down in Mexico there was a small clique of friends who loved Chart, missed her, and remembered her fondly. She was a voracious reader, ace crossword puzzler, and heavyweight Scrabble player. She smoked constantly, Camels, drank enthusiastically, doers with one ice cube, and was in love with peanut butter, sometimes straight out of the jar. She was profane. She had an irreverent streak. A talented artist and illustrator, Chart was fired from a job with Hallmark, according to a friend, after designing a holiday card with a pop-up Jesus Christ inside, arms outstretched. "He has risen," the card read. She was born Patricia Lou Bassett in Kansas City, Missouri, on January 11, 1928. Her parents divorced when she was a baby, and she was raised by her mother and, later, a stepfather. After graduating from Paseo High School in Kansas City with a class of 1944, she moved to New York City to cultivate her career in illustration. The city provided her a platform to find herself. She only realized well into adulthood, for instance, that she was gay. Around that time, a friend named Wendy Johnson became a love interest, then a longtime girlfriend. The two almost became business partners, also became business partners, opening a needlepoint shop on the Upper East Side called Two Needles. In the early 1990s, Chart and Johnson retired to and moved to San Miguel de Allende, a picturesque city about 200 miles northwest of Mexico City that had long been a haven for expatriates. Chart stayed busy in retirement. She went dancing with a soft spot for the Glenn Miller Orchestra. She dressed plainly in slacks and big shirts, but sometimes donned a tuxedo for special events. As Chart grew older and her health declined, she became a begrudging yet diligent member of a local gym. "Why the heck am I not dead yet, Janice?" she would say, in slightly more profane terms, as a sort of ritual greeting to her trainer and longtime friend, Janice McDonald. McDonald described Chart lovingly as a curmudgeon. She had the hard shell of a New Yorker, but inside there was something else, something only her closest friends glimpsed in those moments when she let herself become vulnerable. It was a sadness born of something deep in her past. On a summer night about a year and a half after Chart's death, McDonald was looking at a photograph of her friend on her mantel beside a small jar holding 3 tablespoons of Chart's ashes at her home in San Miguel de Allende. For months, McDonald had been working with Johnson, the lawyer, to settle Chart's will. Her estate was not enormous, but she had divided it with care and generosity. She left thousands of dollars each to 5 of her friends, as well as to 2 former housekeepers and a former hairdresser. Although McDonald and Johnson had never met, they had developed a warm rapport. Knowing that Johnson had never met Chart either, McDonald decided spontaneously to snap a photograph of the frame on her mantle and email it to him. McDonald loved the picture, which shows Chart's face contorted comically in exasperation. "In her arms is a baby boy. I thought you might get a kick out of a photo of Patricia and her son," McDonald wrote. The next morning in New York, Johnson read the email, saw the picture, and was dumbfounded. What? He said to himself. Soon he and McDonald were on the phone. He asked her if Chart indeed had a son. She replied that Chart did. He told her that they needed to find him. "He's dead," McDonald said. She assumed Johnston had known all this. After all, she wondered, hadn't Chart and her son been buried together? Dana Bassett was born in 1954. Though his mother, Chart, had not planned on getting pregnant, she had no relationship with the father and had decided to get an abortion. But when she arrived for her appointment, she found that she could not go through with it. So she fled, literally, said Melanie Nance, a longtime friend. She decided, well, I'm just going to have this baby. Chart raised Dana alone in downtown Manhattan, worrying always about whether she could keep him out of trouble. She showered him with love. It never felt like enough. That anxiety, in part, led her to marry a friend, Abner Chart, when Dana was young. She thought, according to friends, that her son needed a father figure in his life. The marriage did not last very long, but the friendship endured, and she kept his last name. Despite her efforts, Chart's fears were realized. Dana, who kept his mother's maiden name, succumbed to the worst influences around him. He was 14 when heroin entered his life. Slowly, he slipped away. His mother tried sending him to rehab, but to no avail. A few years later, he died of an overdose. Dana's life was cut agonizingly short. Charts crawled on, shattered. In her 60s, she prepared finally to leave New York, the place she had called home for most of her life. She would leave her son behind, yet she did not want him to be alone. So, on January 23, 1989, she buried his ashes at Hartsdale Pet Cemetery. He would rest there with two beloved deceased pets as his companions. Chart's partner, Johnson, later purchased a plot there too. In Mexico, far from the locus of her imperishable pain, Chart found moments of peace. But near the end, she thought increasingly about her son. And though she was a vehement atheist, she often found herself openly pondering the afterlife. "If I die, one of my dreams would be to be with my son," she told Isaac Uribe, a friend in Mexico. Johnson, the lawyer, hung up the phone after talking to McDonald and promptly wrote an email to Martin. "You may recall that you buried the cremated remains of Patricia Bassett Chart at your cemetery last year at our request," he wrote. "I was just told by a close friend of Mrs. Chart that her son's ashes were also buried there at your cemetery after he died as a teenager in the mid-1970s. He added, "If you have any records or information about that, I would be interested to know." Johnson passed along the boy's name, Dana Bassett, and Martin, who had previously only searched for the name Chart, went digging in the cemetery records, eventually discovering that Bassett had been buried there 3 decades ago. Martin left his office, made the short walk downhill to the gravesite, plot L832, and placed his hand on his chest. There on the grass was a small granite headstone. It was jet black. It displayed the names of a dog, Jackie Paper, and a cat, Puff the Magic Dragon. Above those was the name of a boy, Dana Brooks Bassett, and engraved below that was the name Patricia, Chart's first name in block letters. She was meant to be there. She had been there, in a way, all along. The mystery that had shadowed Martin for nearly 2 years was finally resolved. Amid these new revelations, Johnson laid out a few options, including leaving the graves as they were. They had, after all, fulfilled the requests laid out in the will. But for Martin, there was only one thing to do. So on August 19, 2021, 569 days after that first confounding phone call, he walked out of his office to finish, finally, what he had come to see as his solemn duty. On that overcast morning, Martin and two employees extracted Chart's remains from the plot where they had been buried the year before. Together, they walked the ashes some 50 yards along an uphill path to the grave where her son had been waiting for more than 30 years, and consigned them again to the earth. Martin did not know who Chart and Bassett were. He did not know the particulars of their lives, but he knew they should be together. And now, they were. This article originally appeared in the New York Times. Here's one of the health and science stories. The nanoplastics lurking in our water. Water sold in plastic bottles contains many more plastic bits than previously thought. Up to 100 times more, reports CNN.com. Researchers have long known that plastic bottles leach microplastics into our beverages, But now they have identified even smaller nanoplastics. These are tiny particles around 1,000th the width of a human hair that can't be seen under an ordinary microscope. In a new study, researchers from Columbia University found that 1 liter of water from a plastic bottle contained an average of 240,000 plastic bits, of which 90% were minuscule nanoplastics. The particles are so small they can move through tissue into the bloodstream, distributing potentially harmful chemicals such as bisphenols, phthalates, and flame retardants into human organs. If a plastic makes its way into us, it's carrying those chemicals with it, said Sherry Mason from Penn State Barron, who was not involved in the study. The chemicals can be carried to your liver and your kidney and your brain and even make their way across the placental boundary and end up in an unborn child. The researchers used a new technology that can identify nanoparticles by using lasers to observe molecular resonance in the water. Alarmingly, they found not just PET, polyethylene terephthalate, the material in plastic bottles, but also polyamide, the material in water filtration systems. That means nanoplastics might be found in any filtered water, not just water from plastic bottles. And we'll finish out as usual on the Talking Points page. I think we've got time for two articles. Immigration, a border showdown in Texas. The death toll in Texas is rising. Governor Greg Abbott's war on migration, said Alex Driver in CNN.com. After receiving a report last week that several people were struggling in the Rio Grande while crossing from Mexico, Border Patrol agents tried to access the river in Eagle Pass, Texas. But Texas authorities had sealed off a 2.5-mile stretch of the border with fencing and razor wire just days earlier. And the Texas National Guard, the Biden administration says, denied the agents entry. Soon after, Mexican authorities recovered the bodies of a woman, 33, and two children, ages 10 and 8, from the river. Texas called that recounting wholly inaccurate, but there's no denying the cruel anti-immigration program that Abbott has devised. He has installed a floating barrier of buoys and saw blades in the Rio Grande, and after signing a law last month that makes entering Texas illegally a state crime, is now trying to wrest the power the Constitution gives the federal government over immigration. The Biden administration has asked the Supreme Court to step in and clarify Texas immigration authority, or lack thereof, said Jerusalem DeMoss in The Atlantic. But a favorable ruling won't fix the immigration policy vacuum that's behind the chaos at the border. A record 225,000 migrants entered the U.S. illegally at the southern border in December. And immigration courts have a backlog of 3 million cases, many of them asylum claims, triple the number in 2019. President Biden is under pressure to crack down on arrivals, said Michael D. Shear and Miriam Jordan in the New York Times, and not just from usual Republican critics. Democratic mayors of New York and other migrant-deluged northern cities are begging for relief as they grapple with packed shelters and busted budgets. It ups the odds Biden and Democrats will make meaningful concessions to strike a border deal with Republicans. There's one problem, said Andrew Desiderio and Jake Sherman in Punch Bowl News. House Republicans don't want a deal. Speaker Mike Johnson told colleagues this week that a bipartisan measure being hashed out in the Senate is dead in the House, and that Congress won't solve the crisis until a Republican is in the White House. It's an extraordinary omission, said Josh Marshall in Talking Points memo. Johnson is saying openly that he wants to extend the border crisis through November to use it as a political issue. That creates an opening for the White House to put the heat on Republicans. Let's see if they can take it. surrogacy, why the Pope wants it banned. Pope Francis surprised the world last week with his call for a global ban on surrogacy, said Catherine Jean Lopez in National Review. During a speech in which he addressed wars, terrorism, and other threats to humanity, Francis called surrogate motherhood a deplorable practice that commercializes pregnancy and turns the unborn child into an object of trafficking. Many commentators were stunned that this progressive pope would condemn a practice that allows same-sex and infertile couples to have families. Yet this is not simply a matter of Catholic doctrine. Some secular feminists share his belief that surrogacy is inherently exploitative. Doesn't surrogacy, which can cost more than $100,000, use the wombs of the poor to satisfy the desires of the rich? And can a surrogate really give informed consent before she has seen her newborn, which will be taken away immediately and handed over to the commissioning parents? Francis is playing political games, said Fabrice Houdart in Substack newsletter, having offended conservative Catholics by allowing the blessing of same-sex unions. He's now trying to appease them by shifting the attention to another conservative crusade, surrogacy. Are those critics really offended by surrogacy? Or the fact that many of the thousands of surrogate births in the U.S. each year are for LGBTQ families like my own? Presuming surrogacy is always an exploitative last resort for desperate women does not reflect reality, said Elizabeth Nolan Brown in the Dispatch. Research shows that surrogates who typically earn about $40,000 in the U.S. have a variety of motivations. They also largely report positive experiences. One surrogate told a researcher that she was proud to help make a family whole. None of this excuses the buying and selling of children, said Laura Perrins in the Catholic Herald. How can we ignore stories of commercial surrogacy operations in Kenya, where women are forced to have abortions when foreigners decide they don't want a baby? Or how some newborns with disabilities have been abandoned by parents-to-be? Even in the U.S., which lacks federal regulation on surrogacy, some surrogates have reported shocking maltreatment, said Jill Filipovich in CNN.com. But does this ethically thorny practice require the extreme response of the Catholic Church, which historically values procreation over women's bodily autonomy? We need more rules, but ones that preserve choice. Let's treat this issue with the nuance and concern it deserves. And we'll read some of the shorter notes. The world's five richest men have more than doubled their combined wealth since 2020, from $405 billion to $869 billion, according to a new report by Oxfam. Nearly 5 billion people grew poorer during that same period. Republican governors in 15 states have refused to take part in a federally funded program to provide food assistance to hungry children during the summer, depriving 8 million children of the benefit. Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds said the program was not sustainable and would not promote nutrition at a time when childhood obesity has become epidemic. The TSA found 6,737 guns at airport security checkpoints last year, breaking 2022's record of 6,542 firearms. Almost all of the weapons, 93%, were loaded. The top three airports for gun seizures were Atlanta, Dallas, and Houston. U.S. greenhouse gas emissions dipped 1.9% last year, even as the economy grew by 2.4%. A mild winter and declining power generation from coal-fired plants help fuel the drop in emissions. The country would need to triple 2023's rate of decline and sustain that rate every year through 2030 to meet its Paris Agreement target of a roughly 50% reduction in emissions from 2005 levels. On the poll watch, voters who identify as Democrats have declined to the lowest point in 35 years at 27%. Voters who identify as Republicans have also dropped to 27%. 43% of voters identify as independents, tying a record high set in 2014. 46% of Republicans agree with the statement that the country is in a crisis and needs a strong president who should be allowed to rule without too much interference from courts and Congress. 25% of Democrats agree. And we'll finish the show today with a quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn, quoted in the Reno Gazette Journal, who says, "The line separating good and evil passes not through states, not between classes, nor between political parties either, but through every human heart." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. We hope you have enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, or if you have comments or questions, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That's 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.